Are you ready?
Here we go.
Test 1, 2, test 1, 2.
I feel like I'm bouncing from cloud to cloud.
Wow, we're ridiculous.
So stay tuned.
I like what we're doing.
Or don't.
Oh, that might be my favorite thing to ever happen.
Is this not the coolest thing you've ever heard?
Well, how about this?
Yes. Hold up.
It's the Pepper and Dylan After Show Show Podcast.
Welcome to the After Show Show. Today is October 6th, 2021. We always thank you for joining us. We welcome you to welcome new people. Tell six people about it or else don't listen.
We're going to have a guest coming
up. Seven people.
And he is a filmmaker. Is that right? We've had him on an After Show Show before quite some time ago.
Yep. It's been years. Right. And he's a pretty big name. Like, he's got Rogan's number.
Right.
Yes, I've heard him on Joe Rogan.
That he calls regularly, though. Like, he just calls him up, and Joe's like, oh, yeah, my buddy Adam. Like, so, when Joe says, my buddy Adam.
Yeah.
That's famous.
He was part of the that Connor McDavid documentary, Whatever It Takes.
Yeah.
He's been in so many good documentaries.
Right, and he's got some insight on kind of how the film industry is changing right now, which I find incredibly interesting, and I could talk for hours about it, and just about how the way we consume content is so different now. And continually changing. And it's part of the reason why, and not to beat a dead horse, which might be the most awful reference possible, considering what I'm about to say, but this Gabby story, which is why I am kind of still have, you know, a percentage of me that thinks it's a fabricated story concocted for content on the internet.
She died.
I know.
So but it's not.
It could just be a story that's just playing out in still photos
Maybe
and videos.
She might be in
look,
on it.
Okay, I get it. I get that that's over. But what I'm saying is, you know, for me, and then we were talking this morning on the show about the Squid Games. Mm. And I'm like, how far off are we from that being a real thing and that being content where they're actually killing people that lose? The old Running Man was a movie. You know, the Hunger Games. And it's just, I am very curious on the evolving...
Wouldn't that be like reverse evolution? Like, didn't they used to kill people back in the
day? That's a good point, right? Everything comes full circle.
Right? Like, that would be just going back.
But the way that we just kind of, the evolving nature of how we consume content and how it's gone from, you know, people used to listen to stories on the radio. That was the thing.
I loved that when I was growing up.
Right? And then television. And then... You know, they're movies into 3D movies, into the now you're podcasting. Movies are almost on their way out. Newspapers are long gone. Right. I don't know what's happening with radio. Just on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And the movie industry, or just the viewing industry, has changed so much in television in the way that, like, Dylan, you don't have cable anymore.
No, like, I was having a talk, like, the other night, like I was saying, with my friend for like an hour and a half, and he's in the industry, and just like, I was like, whoa. Yeah. That doesn't sound good.
Right.
There's a lot of things that don't sound good as they move forward, especially for like, like the big companies and the huge names are always going to be all right. But it's the smaller names that are going to have a problem with all these streaming services. It's very interesting.
But the rich get richer in the streaming services, just the world that we're living in. And Netflix doesn't seem to find any need to tell its filmmakers or its actors that are up here in the content that they're producing anything about the content that they are producing.
Right, because the way that I understood it from the conversation I was having, and it was a hazy conversation, I will say, but that like the Scarlett Johansson thing that happened was like...
Well, let's call Adam right now.
Okay.
Okay, and then have him join in on the conversation, because the credibility we have, you were getting high with Buzz in your garage from Home Alone.
I didn't smoke any, but there was a lot of cloud around my head.
Secondhand.
I believe there was some of that.
We can use some of what you gleaned there, and plus Adam's credibility as a very notable filmmaker who's been involved locally and, you know, to some degree, because he had that marijuana documentary, right?
Yeah, two.
Hello.
Hey, Adam. It's Pepper and Dylan. It's been a while since we've spoken with you. You were in studio, so this is only a long time ago because it feels like that.
Yeah, before the world changed.
Yeah, and we talked about, which documentary was it that we talked about that you were getting ready to put out at the time?
At that time, it was probably...
it was Weedy.
We talked about my original doc.
The Culture High.
And the Union. Yeah.
Okay. And then you were talking about potentially, was it the Oilers maybe you were doing something? I don't know.
I was doing Grant Furis.
That's what it was. Yeah. Yes.
Coco, yeah.
Right. Okay. And since then, you've been involved with the Connor McDavid, the rehab documentary, or I guess docu-series that we watched. Yep. Is that right?
Yeah. Did that.
And I watched Over the Barrel. I watched Soul on Ice.
So wow. And then we did Danny Trejo's Inmate Number 1.
That looks
pretty
cool.
And then we just finished Michael Bisping's. That'll be really, that's on Super Channel in Canada right now, but we're releasing worldwide. And I just got back from Europe yesterday because we're filming Dolph Lundgren's documentary now, Ivan Drago.
Oh, wow.
From the Rocky movies.
Yeah.
So
I loved Ivan Drago.
You have for years.
That is an underrated Rocky, man. Rocky IV, underrated.
For sure. Well, they're just doing a new, so we were at the Arnold Classic in Birmingham in the UK, and Dolph was doing autographs. And you think, like, he's 63 now, right? Going to be 64.
Yeah.
And you'd think, like, okay, yeah, they're going to do signing. There'll be a few people. There was 5,000 people lined up to meet Ivan Drago today. Like, it went all around the block, down the stairs, around the thing. Like, he is the most iconic villain in the Rocky series, no question.
Yes. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So you've made a lot of, how many films have you made or been part of?
I think it's like, I'd like 10 features now, probably like 14 with shorts and stuff like that. Right. I think
the show that you have the bona fides, how many awards are on the shelf in your office?
We just recently won. We cleaned out, so we went 5 for 5 with the Danny Trejo one. And then we won 5 with Bisbing between the Ampias and Lynn. So it's starting to get up there, but it's a team thing. Cause we went for sound and music and other things as well. It doesn't just go to me, but they're getting up there. I think we're at like over close to a dozen with like 30 nominations.
So it's great to exploit the relationships we make with people who listen to our radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Adam, you've been listening to our show for a while, and then we found out that you do this, and we thought this is cool, so we talked to you a long time ago, and we want to talk to you again today. I could have this conversation for hours because I find it fascinating, and I don't know what all we want to touch on, but Dylan was hanging out with Buzz from Home Alone.
Yes.
Yeah. That was interesting. I heard the debate today with, like, is he a celebrity or something? There is something special about those movies because, like, to me, they're one of the greatest Christmas movies. Like, me and my kids watch them every year.
Right.
And they're funny every year. Right. Only the first two Home Alones. I never got to the third. It's like, once Macaulay Culkin and them are out, like, they're... But the first two, we laugh at them every year. And I thought about that as, like, being in the film business. Being like, man, like, I wonder if they knew that they were going to be this iconic Christmas movie that, like, you watch that and then you watch Chevy Chase Christmas, maybe the Rudolph one. Like, there's, like, 5 that... you have to watch every year. And that is, those two, my kids are like, let's watch them again and again and again.
But it's the John Hughes touch, is it not?
I totally think so. There's something very special about those.
Because, like, Christmas Vacation, Home Alone, both John Hughes movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did. Yeah, wow. Everything was
right?
Amazing. He
yeah.
did.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, a John Hughes
movie.
You
love that one. Right?
It's a great vacation. It's a Thanksgiving movie more than it is a Christmas movie, but it's a holiday movie nonetheless. John Hughes, he's fantastic.
Well, and you know what, something this kind of goes into where you guys were talking about Netflix is there's, with everything being so immediate and quick now, you definitely see it in the way storytelling and everything is done now. Like there is something magical about those movies done there. And it's not just nostalgic because that's when we first saw them. There is something now, like movies have to grab your attention so much faster because they're online. Like you guys said, like Netflix, it's like 2 minutes cues in. Like if a movie doesn't grab you in the first 7 minutes, people are just going to the next one because they're so readily available.
It's true.
Right? Growing up, we'd go to the movie store and you'd hope that, like, the big movie was in, right? Or you'd check the return bin and be like, yes, there's a copy. Like, it was something special to get it. Now the access is so easy. And then people now, I see it in my industry all the time, that if people can't get your film right away, they just steal it. Like, they think it's, like, literally okay for them to do that. They're like, well, I couldn't find it on... I don't have Super Channel, so I just found a VPN and stole it.
Yeah, I ran into that with that damn Wu-Tang television, season 2 of the Wu-Tang. Mm-hmm. It's a scripted kind of chronicle of how Wu-Tang Clan came to be.
Yeah.
And you can't find it anywhere. And, you know, it's on Hulu. And, God, I can't get Hulu. I can't get Hulu.
Yeah, can.
Why can't I get Hulu?
Yeah, it's a weird with, because even now, like, we have Bisbing is only because Super Channel helped bring that to light. So it's available in Canada right now, but the UK's freaking out, being like, what idiots are you guys that you didn't release it in the UK? Bisbing's from here. We're like, man, it's coming, but that's coming with a big studio deal that's coming afterwards. Like the release, everybody wants now to control the release, kind of like we were talking about where, you know, you used to be able to sell the Christmas movies to all the different broadcasters. But once anything goes on Netflix, once it's online, all your other revenue streams are gone,
right?
Once it's free and available and you can get it anywhere, then nobody else makes money. So you want to try to exploit all those as much as possible before it hits a streaming service, unless the streaming service wants it before anybody else. And that's the thing is, although it's hard to negotiate with Netflix, if they want your project, like, they can just add zeros to the offer, right? They've got more money than anybody.
But where is all this money? Like,
well, look at, remember spending. We did the math? We had Robbie do the math of how many users there were by $20 a month. It was astronomical what they made a month.
But the amount of money they are investing, and I wouldn't even call it smart investing. They're just throwing money at everything to try and have everything.
But here, Pepper, here's how their business model crushes everybody. So say we're looking, let's compare a big blockbuster movie. That's the best example. So Marvel, you know, even though those are licensed print money, you spend $200 million to make that movie, but probably another $100 million to market it, right? Mm-hmm. So $300 million. Now the time from when that starts to when it starts collecting revenue, let's say conservatively is 2 years. Imagine the interest ticking on $300 million sitting for 24 months, right? Or if things had to push back for COVID, it would be like the meter in Chevy Chase's Christmas, like, would be racking up, right? Netflix gets revenue into their account on the first of every month, over $1 billion. They get 120 million subscribers right into their account.
Yeah.
And then their payment terms normally suck. So when you do a Netflix deal, you're like, sweet, we just landed a big deal. So Netflix goes, oh, no, no, we don't give you the money to go make it. We'll give you 10%. Once you deliver the project, then every quarter for the next 4 years, we will pay that deal. Mm-hmm. So the producers, like us, we're carrying that money for 4 years before they finally pay it out. So they've always got the payment terms where they're collecting revenue, and although they're paying these big fees, they're paying them on drawn-out payment schedules that last for years. So they're getting way more revenue in than they're paying out.
But they don't pay an amount of money based on the popularity of your show because they don't reveal how many people, like to the producer.
You're half correct. So they do. They know how good it is, but they never tell you so you can't negotiate against them.
Right.
Right? But, so that you, like they, even I've worked with Joe Rogan a lot, and he said that too, where they'll be like, hey, how's it going? They're like, great. We want to do another one with you. And they're like, cool. What's the numbers? So like, it's doing great. They're like, well, what are the numbers? Like, you just, it's doing great. We're happy. Let's do another one. They never want to tell you because it's, that's their negotiating
and
tool.
And because
right?
they're such a big entity,
you have to be,
you
want to
be on it, right?
You want to be, they're the ones at the festivals. Like if you go to a festival and you have a bidding war, which is every filmmaker's dream, they're the one that can usually come in with more money than anybody. They're the one, if they really want it, like, you know, say the other bids are at a million, Netflix is big, okay, we'll just give you four. Bids are over. We're done.
Whoa. They'll just kill it just like that.
Yeah. We've got it, right? We do the release. But that thing is, once it goes on there, it's done. Like, no other revenue because it's available everywhere for free.
So they're trying to monopolize entertainment.
Yeah.
Right.
They've shifted the power in a different way because like studios and everybody had it before, so it's just a shift of power. But you know, now you've got other streaming services and stuff putting a little bit of checks and balances in there, right? Because everybody's trying to do their own streaming.
Well, they also come from such a great financial backing as well, right? Like you look at Disney and Amazon, like they're no joke when it comes to revenue as well.
No, and if they want something, like that's ultimately, you know, every filmmaker's dream. Like I do docs. I don't usually have Disney in there because my stuff's a little more than the PG side for them, but they, you know, I would love nothing more than if you had like an HBO, Universal, Netflix, and Amazon bidding war. That's every filmmaker's dream, right? Then you might actually be able to put, you know, enough away to buy like that lake house or something, right?
If they come what's happening, and this is what we were talking about in the garage the other night.
With Buzz.
Right, it was Buzz and
was Buzz buzzing?
He was really buzzing.
Okay.
But so then I don't know how much there is truth to this story or not, but like, so Scarlett Johansson was suing Disney because when the film Black Widow came out, the idea was Black Widow was going to be that it was going to be a theater release.
Yep.
And so she makes money based on the theater release, and that's kind of how he says actors and actresses make their money, is how much can you bring in as a theater release? And that's kind of like your opening
They're
weekend.
Banking on themselves.
Right.
Correct, yep.
And so this is what she was doing, is that she was going to do that. But then what they did is COVID happened, so they opened it both in the theater and on Disney at the exact same time, and she's suing them saying, well, you totally cut my legs out from me because I would have made
way more.
Because
she only got a cut of the theater money. She didn't get a cut of the streaming money.
Right, she wasn't able to get that, and this is happening more and more again. Traditionally, it's like 90 days that you would be in the theater before it then goes to a streaming service, and you'd have that opportunity. I mean, it's still gross, like $218 million.
Now, she won the lawsuit, though, did she not?
I believe.
Or did they just settle it?
There was a settlement, I believe. But no, Dylan, you're bang on that. And that is a struggle with it now, is that, you know, if you had your deal set up where you were going to get box office, and let's be honest, like you know, Rogue, it was a great movie, and her being the female lead, she was probably going to set a whole bunch of box office records, right? Even despite COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But because they did that, now a lot of those like bonus points don't get hit, right? It is like, you know, I obviously I'm not dealing with talent like at that level, but that is a big thing where, and I mean, we have that if our docs, if you hit certain price points and you'll get bonuses, and it is a shiesty way that they can be like, oh, well, we put it on platforms, so then we drop those numbers, right? But this has always kind of been the film world, is that there will be marketing expenses that you're like, wow, like even in my, for our Danny Trejo one, which we did with Universal Studios, which, you know, for a documentary out of Canada, very few people get studio deals. It's very, very rare. I think maybe last year in the entire country, there's two or three. And we were one of them. You know, then they'll have like miscellaneous. There's $100,000 in miscellaneous charges, U.S. And I'm like, what is that? And you can't question them because you want to go back to them for them to buy your next one, right? So you're like, $100,000 in miscellaneous charges? Like, I could see maybe $5,000, $10,000.
Right.
But they you're dealing with the machine at that point, right? Where, you know, this is why you try to front load your deals, where you get it up front, because they can always add expenses and stuff in the back. And even if you go to court and do all that stuff, usually only the lawyers win there.
Right.
And then so that's what we ended up talking about, is the fact that, like, because he's not a huge actor,
yeah,
but he was making good money because Home Alone is played so often for so many years. He was making great money as just kind of, like he said, every time it plays anywhere, he would get like a small residual check from it.
Now that it's streaming.
But yeah, now that it's on Disney, it's not the same. So he said he used to, like, anything he's ever been in, the Screen Guild or whatever it is, will give you a cut from where it gets played. So, but he's like, now when what happens is these streaming services take over, and because it's only getting played at one place, you're only getting that small cut. And by the sounds of it, Adam, if it is, if it's someone like Netflix, they don't even tell you how good it's doing. They probably just tell you, here's what you're going to get, the end.
Yeah, well, no, they would, Dylan. They would just do a lump sum. So if they buy the rights to Home Alone, they would say, okay, we're going to buy it for 3 years, right? And then they can play it as many times as they want. They could play it 100 million times,
mm-hmm,
and they're going to just pay whatever. Just say they said, we're going to buy it for $1 million for 3 years, right? And we can play it as many times as we want, worldwide, all territories, all dubs. So then the actors would only get the residual check from that initial deal, right? That's it.
Yeah.
There'd be no bonuses. Whereas when it was selling to every teeny, you know, if it's like CBC bought it again for Christmas, and then Global, and then UK, and then NBC, and you could sell it to all the different ones, they would constantly get all these different residual checks because those would all be new deals. So yeah, there's pros and cons to all this. I see it, you know, something I look at now, or even me, I do factual content, and my kids nowadays, and Pepper, you have some young kids that, you know, they usually don't even watch like structured shows now.
No.
It's like TikTok and YouTube, right? Like my kids are all about YouTubers, and I'm like, man, watch regular shows. I don't want to, like, I want to continue to make entertainment.
Right.
I'm not a YouTuber.
The only shows we have with my kids are Ted Lasso. We watch that as a family. My daughter still binges Friends. Mm-hmm. Like, she turns it on and just falls asleep to Friends.
That's good.
And I think
Riley loves Breaking Bad.
Riley was watching Breaking Bad for a while.
Right.
But I want to talk to you about a bunch of things. I want to talk about documentaries, too, because I think since the last time we talked, documentaries have experienced an explosion in popularity. Like, documentaries are the new content, almost.
It's the golden age of docs, for sure.
But I wanted to touch on, quickly, before that, is television dead? And how long until television's dead? And is sports the only thing really, truly keeping it alive?
That's a great question, and I constantly go back and forth on this, and I think it is and it isn't. The other thing that keeps, because I know in my household, the only reason we have television is for sports, and then for my wife's reality television shows.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, those were not on streaming services, but now Netflix is getting into
them. Oh, yeah. Now there's tons of them now.
And they're doing well on there, so it does seem like it's only a matter of time, but, you know, they're clever. All these TV shows, all these TV networks are now getting their own streaming service, right? Like NBC has Peacock, and you've got all these ones. Like, so I think they're going to suck you in, where it's going to, like, originally that was why you'd go away from TV, is because you could get streamed, like, oh, I'll just get Netflix and Disney and my basic cable, I'm good. But now they're kind of going to say, oh, no. Well, you have to get, like, the package. You have to stack it now. You have to get Peacock and TV and Disney. And you're going to end up paying, like, it seems like we're paying more now.
Well,
like,
that's
you got
it.
Your cable bill
right.
down, and now you're back.
That's
right?
100% it. Like, it's the thing that forced us away from television to streaming, or attracted us to streaming, was, well, we've got all this content on one or two platforms. It's so much cheaper, $15, $20 a month. But now you're adding up all these, it's cheaper to go back to television. That might be the thing that saves television.
Am I going to bring it? Yeah, I don't know. It's a great question, but I see it. I do know when we go on the road now, like we just did this long trip in Europe. We were in like five countries for almost 3 weeks, and we never turn the TVs on anymore. And a lot of places don't even really have a TV when you go to Airbnbs and stuff now, because we all just are watching our Netflix shows, right? Whereas
on our own devices too.
Yeah, on our own devices. You might have turned on the basic to get the basic news and stuff like that, but even the news shows up on your social media and stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Which is,
yeah, local news is dying.
Yeah. What is the difference, like, between a movie and a documentary, like, as far as, like, time to make? Like, you say it's the golden age, but can you produce them just as fast, or if not faster than, like, the big movies, or is it the same kind of process?
No, we actually take longer because can't, you know, with a movie, if it's an indie film, like, they have, you know, 20 or 30 shoot days to get everything. We stagger it over, you know, long periods. Like, that's like literally Dolph was like, hey, I'm working on Expendables 4 and the new Aquaman. You know, you guys should come while I'm in Spain and these places. And then he's from Sweden originally. So we're like, oh, perfect. We'll go interview your family. You know, it's only a 2 hour or 4 hour flight from Spain. And so we went over it because we're always capturing like great, like you want the contemporary story, but then you also have the talking heads and the backstory of where he came and how he got into all this stuff. So ours usually takes longer. And that's usually what I explain to the talent when they're like, okay, because they're like, yeah, you can bang this out in a month. I'm like, well, no, what are you doing in the next year, right? And then Dolph's about to go for ankle surgery that he's been hiding for years. He destroyed his ankle when he was, you know, mandatory military service in Sweden when he was younger, and they always said he'd never be able to do sports and anything like that again. He's like pretty funny looking back, considering I became an action star and was a world champion in Taekwondo or in Kokushin karate for Sweden, even though at 18 I was told I'd never walk on my ankle again. You know, so we have to get all those contemporary pieces. So if he's like, oh, I'm going for surgery and we'd like to get that, we have to stagger it kind of over 6 to 8 months, right? And then we start editing, and as something else comes up, sometimes we hold out for it. So normally our docs take about 18 months from, you know, concept to like delivery. And then when we're done and we deliver, then it might be another 6 to 8 months, depending on when's the best time to release.
Right. Well, and the
editing. You don't want to compete against certain things. Yeah, the editing takes 6 to 8 months.
I couldn't even think of hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage. And trying, and yeah, you can make notes while you're filming, but hundreds of hours, and then trying to weave together a narrative that fits
the
vision.
90 minutes.
Yeah.
It's, I know, I work with tremendous editors, and that's a skill that is a whole other, you know, and picking those tender moments where maybe you caught them when they're doing an interview and they're reflecting, right, as they go through their life story and they get emotional and those things, and making sure you're hitting, even if it's subtle emotion, like you just actually really see them thinking deeply about your question and stuff like that, right, that you're capturing all those things. It is a process, but I think why it's the golden age, why people are connecting, because we live in a generation now where, you know, news particularly has become about, not about being right or accurate, about being first, because we want everything so quick. So that's why news will put out an article that totally butchers, like, even if they say follow the, it's been really frustrating with COVID because they say follow the science, but the science changes every 2 weeks. And then even the news outlets, you know, telling you the science don't know how to articulate it correctly because it's a young journalist and they're trying to get the numbers out quick. Right. And then if they do a retraction 2 weeks later, nobody reads the retraction.
Right.
I think now with docs, people are kind of like, man, I want something that is just, oh, this is this guy's story, like refreshing. And I grew up watching it, and that's my genre. Like for me, when the opportunity to work with Dolph came, I was like, honestly, this one is super special because I grew up watching like Masters of the Universe and Rocky and Universal Soldier and Red Scorpion and, you know, all those movies, the original Punisher that he was. So for me, it was so special to be like, man, that brings a really like special moment of me, of like when TV and watching a movie was with your family was a big thing. And docs can kind of take you back on that journey, right, and really tell you the real story of somebody. And I think that's why people are resonating with them so much, because movies now are just like churned out on these programs where if they don't have a built-in audience, like, you know, when I was younger, it used to be those guys. I was an action star guy where I used to literally say to my dad, when you go to the video store, I'm like, anything with Arnold, Stallone, Van Damme, or Dolph, just get it, right?
Yes.
I watched even all the bad ones that people were like, I'd never watched it when I was a kid. I loved it. you know, guy, go fight the bad guys, kick ass, and take names. Yeah, it's awesome. Right?
I was the same. My house was the right? same. Does Netflix view the documentary, like, is there like a pay grade that's different? Like, okay, well, movies that are going to be blockbuster movies, we'll pay at this. Documentaries, we pay at this. Or is it like by project that they view it?
Generally, movies are worth more, right? Just because there is still a lot of people that aren't into docs or whatever. But if you have something that, you know, Netflix is all about their algorithms. They literally take your project and punch it into a computer. And if it hits the right things, they come after it hard. Right. So you, again, what you always want is, this is why festivals are still, why the film festival still matters, because if you can go, and people are still, we have emotional tendencies. So if you're in a theater and you're experiencing, you know, Danny Trejo or Dolph's story, and you're getting emotional and you're seeing the crowd get emotional, people are laughing and tearing up and really enjoying this experience. And then Dolph comes on stage afterwards and talks about everything that you saw in the film. And of course, as an emotional buy, you're going to be like, we need this, right? We're seeing the crowd's reaction. We have to get it, right? So then that's when you get your bidding war, hopefully, because you have HBO and all those guys in there. And I've been in these screenings where none of them try to show their cards. Like, if they see the audience, they deliberately try not to laugh, or they try not to have emotion because they don't want other buyers to see that they're getting emotionally swayed.
Right.
So they try to play it really cool to be like, oh, it wasn't that funny. Yeah, it was okay. Yeah, we might put in an offer, right? But that's why you want to do it at a big festival of hundreds of people, because then it's hard to hide that, right? And you get that bidding war.
Mm-hmm.
Versus you send them a link, and who knows, they're watching in their office, they're getting distracted, their wife's calling them, or, you know, their husband's calling, they're watching, they're pausing it, and they're skipping parts, and then they're on their phone, you know, and they're like, ah, yeah, it's okay, we'll give you an offer, right? That's why you want to try to get them down in that theater where there's nobody on their phone, they're watching, they're experiencing it. And you can get, there is those ones. Like, that's, I think, what always makes the movie industry exciting, is that you can make a movie and you can get that grand slam. You can get that life-changing film that crushes at Sundance and has the bidding war, and, you know, they announce like big doc sale, you know, Dolph Lundgren doc sells for $6 million to Sony or something, right? You you can get those, but generally the feature films, dramatic features with actors, will sell more than a documentary 9 times out of 10.
How do you even get into the film festival?
Now that, without getting too political, is you submit through, like, online, through traditional methods. They have a program called Film Freeway, which is actually started by a Canadian company. And you submit your project, you put all your stuff in there. But as we're learning, like, to blindly submit and just be like, oh, I'm Adam Scorgi from Edmonton, I'm going to submit this to Sundance, your chances of getting in are, like, so rare, because they get 12 to 15,000 submissions and they only pick 200 films. Now, out of those 200, you're also dealing with people that sponsor the festival. Of course, their film's going to have a little bit more say. You've got alumni that are submitting that are going to have a little bit more say.
Right.
You've got celebrities that they know that they can do a big hype and sell off that are going to get a bit more say. So you're dealing with all those things. So the top tier, the festivals that everybody knows, the famous ones, Sundance, Toronto International, you know, Cannes, Con, however you pronounce it, Venice, those ones are really hard to get into. And I've never, my team and I were 0 for 11 on those. We always get told no. I just wait for the, unfortunately, you didn't get in this.
Really?
Right. Yeah, never got in. But it's funny, because then we get, you know, there's a lot of films that will premiere there, and then they'll come to my sales agent looking to try to sell afterwards, right? Where we've kind of done with our last two films, getting studio deals for documentaries. I believe we're the only independent company in Canada that's accomplished that, like, back to back. And, you know, other films that we compete against go to the festivals and don't get those deals. So we know we're making good content, but it isn't always just about the best film that gets into the festivals. There's marketing, and there's, you know, there's political views behind it too. If there's a certain political, you know, thing that's connecting with audiences around the world right now, of course, festivals will try to get into, they'll ride that wave, right, and get into that. So that's a whole other business side that we do a lot of the local festivals, like Calgary Film Festival has been great to us. And, you know, a lot of the, what's considered tier two or tier three festivals are great. And it is still as a filmmaker, there's nothing better than watching your film with an audience.
Right.
Because even though you've watched it 100 times in the editing room, when you see other people having an emotional connection to your work, there's nothing more addicting. That's the moment I knew I had to be a filmmaker. It's the first time we did a sellout screening and people were laughing and tearing up. And I remember being like, wow, I'm never going to be able to do anything else.
As a documentarian with a bunch of projects behind your belt and a bunch of awards on your shelf, and you saying it's the golden age for docs, do we thank true crime? Do we thank food documentaries. Remember? Mm. All right, take a look at the chickens that you're actually eating. Remember that that trend for a little while?
Yes.
And then they sneak in. It's just a commercial for juicers. Or do we thank BBC and those animal, what do they call
David
it?
David Attenborough.
The David Attenborough documentaries.
Like Planet Earth.
Who do we point at and say thank you for launching documentaries back into the forefront of entertainment?
Oh,
true crime.
PBS?
That's a great... No, you know, I wouldn't say it's any one thing. If I had to say, as like, one thing that you didn't mention that's a big thing is streaming, making it easily accessible for people.
Sure, because, yeah, finding a documentary back in the day was impossible. You'd have to go to one of those theaters that you didn't know where it was.
Yeah, and, it would be like an IMAX that was hard to get to, and like making it easily accessible and, you know, the algorithm saying, hey, you watch these other things, this would interest you, right? Where you're like, oh, that would interest me. That is my kind of genre I'm into. Click away and having the ease of access where that has really helped. But definitely, like, I mean, you can't take away, like, you know, like Michael Moore, Morgan Spurlock, Alex Gibney. Those guys also made documentaries, like, mainstream. Like, those were some of the first ones that I went, or Werner Herzog, where you actually went to a theater to be like, I'm going to go to a theater to watch a documentary.
I remember, you know, seeing Bowling for Columbine in the theater.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That was one of the ones that really, I think everybody, like, almost, and it's one of, still one of the top 10 grossing documentaries of all time. So I think it'd be a combination of a lot of things, but I know for a lot of people, you know, the same thing that we talked about earlier in the conversation, that the ease of access, it like, you know, dilutes the films. It also makes it so much where people are like, well, I don't have to pay $5.99. This looks like an interesting subject. I'm willing to click on it for 10 minutes. And then, of course, like a great doc usually pulls you in, and then you're like, you're in, you're down, you're like, wow. I never knew that he did that. I never knew, you know, like Guys with Dolph. You're like, I never knew he was a legitimate martial
artist. Well, and that's the thing. You've got to have one hell of a trailer.
Yes.
Because I'll see a documentary and go, in a million years, I would never be interested in something like this. And then when I watch the trailer, I think, you know what? I'm going to check this out.
Oh, I love him. I love him. Do you ever think that there would be a streaming service strictly documentary?
There is kind of some out there, but they don't seem to...
too niche.
It's too niche that they're not profitable enough. But the good thing is you hear all the big ones, like Amazon, Netflix, all of them have a healthy appetite for, it's a smaller, it's like 10% of their catalog, but they are all, you know, definitely continuing to buy, you know, look at like Tiger King during the, now there's a lot of things that got lucky with Tiger King. Let's just call a spade there.
Sure.
That's a train wreck that you can't take your eyes off of, right? But I think if it would have released before the pandemic, nobody would have been talking about it the way it was, right? Mm-hmm. But it hit at the perfect time. There's nothing else to compete against. All the big movies were pulling back their theatrical releases and everything, and that was this crazy train wreck with what was going on with the
people
world, where you're like, wow.
Home.
And you're just like, wow, as bad as things are, this shit is even crazier. Yeah. These people's lives is even more fucked
up. Well, it's right? kind of like there's this kind of thin gray line between reality TV and documentaries, and that's where Tiger King and Making a Murderer kind of fit,
right?
That it's reality, but it's edited with sometimes an agenda. It's edited to be a little more sensational, and then you've got the true documentaries, and it's maybe the as much as I know I personally, I watch reality TV and I'm like, I just can't take it. It's too fabricated, but it maybe that's what's kind of launched. Hey, as long as I'm seeing something that feels more authentic than scripted television,
right,
maybe I'll keep pushing my interest, widening my interest in it, and it's evolved into real, true, well done documentaries.
Pepper, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that combined with, like, you know, we've even seen how manipulated media is now, where one side pushes one angle, the other side pushes another angle, and then, like you said, reality shows, and then even scripted shows now, like, just the way that even there, it's usually for financial reasons, but even they push kind of political agendas and undertones with the actors and everybody, where people are like, oh man, can I not even, like, even in my kids' movie, you're pushing political agendas with undertones? Like, I just want to watch a doc where you're not pushing any of that stuff, right? Where it's just a bio doc, and this is a cool person that I grew up watching or listening to or knew a little bit about, that people find that refreshing and they just want a little taste of that. I think that's definitely a big part of why docs have, you know, connected with so many people today and is the golden age.
The Pepper and Dylan Show.
I wonder, when you're making a documentary, like you say Dolph Lundgren, right?
Yeah.
And you have to do a lot of research on Dolph Lundgren to think this would be a really interesting documentary to follow him around with, because, I mean, Dolph Lundgren is kind of from days gone by. Danny Trejo, or Trejo, he has an interesting life, so a little easier to research to know his story. But sometimes do you find yourself, like, it's a bit of a leap of faith to go and invest the time and planning and energy and staff into a documentary that maybe halfway through you're like, God, maybe this isn't very interesting. How the hell are we going to do this?
Yeah, this is why we usually, before we do, we like to meet them and really dive in and have a director look. And that's what we did with Dolph. I mean, instantly I was interested because childhood connection, right? I was like, man, it's the original He-Man. This is amazing. It's cool. Yeah. But then, like, what is the hook? Then when you look into a story and you find out that he was actually, like, going to be a chemical engineer and got a full ride, Fulbright scholarship to MIT, which is like where rocket scientists and chemical, like, he was a chemical engineer, graduated highest of his class, brilliant students, right? That, and then you find out where Dolph is very open about, you know, the abuse from his father growing up. And that's why he became such a good student. And that's why he got into martial arts, is that he was always looking for approval of his father, right? And he couldn't get it. And he was the only one out of his siblings that his dad targeted. And he is very, there's a TED talk that he does about this that is, if it doesn't bring a tear to your eye and make you look, and then even how in this, you know, we're in a generation where we're talking about much more diversity and everything, is that how he was attacked constantly throughout his career simply because of the way he looked. People assumed he was a big, dumb, blonde jock, right? But he's like, man, I'm a chemical engineer. He took a huge risk. And that he had a full ride scholarship, you know, that he had the Scandinavian dream, where he was going to America under a Fulbright scholarship for MIT, going to be a chemical engineer. And he dropped out after the first semester. He met Grace Jones, working security for one of her events. And he jokes about that pretty good. And he's like, I didn't understand why she wanted to have me as her head of security, as this, like, young Swedish guy. And he's like, the first day she invited me up to her hotel room, I figured out very quickly why she hired me. Ooh. It wasn't just for my security ability. and they got romantic, and she was the one that got him into the film industry.
So there's... Sorry, continue.
No, that's where... And he has a really interesting story where he's like... Because, you know, you always talk about, you know, there's that faker syndrome where people feel like, man, I don't really feel like I deserve this. And he has one of the most definitive moments where, like, when did you realize that you were going to become a star, right? Like, not just a, you know, an actor, a star. He's like, it was one night. He's like, we were going to the Rocky IV premiere, and I walked in with Grace Jones, and everybody was paying attention to her. They're all like, Grace, photo here, photo here. He's like, I walked out of the theater. He's like, I walked into the theater as, you know, Grace Jones's boyfriend, and I walked out of the theater as Dolph Lundgren, the movie star. Because when I walked out, nobody was interested in Grace Jones.
Right.
They were all like, Dolph. And Stallone talked about how when Dolph came into his office, like, he originally was looking for, like, a hairy kind of, like, grizzly bear looking Russian, like this, like, crazy, wild, yelling, screaming, like, kind of guy that would eat you. He's like, he had a very different look for what he wanted.
Wouldn't have been the same
villain movie.
No, he needed to look like him.
So then when he said, when Dolph came in, he was like, oh my God, he's like, this guy, he's like, if you were picturing, like, the genetic guy that was going to take, he's like, this, he's like, guys are going to hate him just because he looks perfect.
He's beautiful.
He's blonde, his physique, he's tall, he speaks well. He's like, and Dolph actually was a competitive boxer and did martial arts, so he could actually do the physicality required. And his acting coach, Dolph's acting coach, Larry Moss, a very iconic acting coach, said, I want you to play it differently. I want you to play it stoic, like you're the hero from Russia, not the villain to America. And that's why in his audition, he just did the whole thing like, I must break you. Yeah. I come here to win and beat the Rocky.
Yeah.
And he ultimately, and then there's the funny stories, which we'll reveal in the doc, is that at this point, Grace Jones loved to party and always wanted to go out and party at Studio 54 till 5 in the morning. And Dolph's like, I had to train with Stallone at 6 in the morning. So Stallone finally said, no more of that. You're moving in with me in my guest house. And he lived with Stallone for 4 to 6 months, and they would train every morning. Cool. To go get ready. So you want to talk about physical preparedness. This is something that the action stars don't get enough credit for. Everybody's like, they're not that good an actor. He trained for 6 months, 6 days a week with Stallone at 5, 6 a.m. every day, and had his diet down to, like, he could have one piece of meat, a potato, and some vegetables for 6 months.
Ugh.
The choreography, all the stuff in order to prepare to look the character that they did, right, to go shoot.
You haven't seen it, have you, Dylan, Rocky IV?
I can't. I'm looking it up right now. I, like, recognize him, but I don't know.
Yeah, he's so recognizable.
I can't put that.
I mean, Sorry, go ahead.
I just want to, as someone who makes documentaries, I mean, I'm sitting on one right now that I bet half the world is, right?
An idea?
To follow the, and I don't know if you know anything about it, Adam, it's the Gabby Petito story. It is unfolding in front of us right now. It would make the best documentary ever. I'm assuming somebody's out there following it and already thinking this, but like, how do you go from that? Like, I had the idea at the very beginning. I'm like, oh, this would make a great documentary. The end. Yep. That's all that that's where my mind is. But like, the story's unfolding day by day. I'm on Twitter and I can't even imagine what you put into it, because I'm on Twitter just as somebody that cares about the story 3 hours a day, at least for the last 2-3 weeks. And I got nothing to win here, but like, I'm like, someone's got to be following this. Someone's got to be getting this. Someone's got to be collecting all this, all these articles and contacting all these people. I'm assuming someone's doing that, but how does that all come together?
So generally what we do to start, Dylan, that's a great point, is that usually what I start with is life rights, right? Because like, then that way, if somebody else comes up with the idea or whatever, is you acquire the life rights, right? If you think that there's something that is tangible and it can go sell, I acquire the life rights, and then what I go do is I pre-sell it in Canada, and that's kind of how me and my team get paid. And then we sell the international rights, right? I'll sell it to Super Channel, normally is my best client. They're right here in Edmonton, Alberta. That's why I moved here. And then they just lock up TV, but then that'll trigger our tax credits and everything else. So usually the first step is acquiring the life rights. Then we create what's called a pitch deck, or like a Bible and like a treatment, which is essentially your business plan, right? Which is often a lot of people forget when they're like, I have this idea, right? And I meet young filmmakers and I speak at panels and they're like, I got this idea. I'm like, that's great. What can you show me? And they're like, well, nothing. I just have an idea. I'm like, well, then you have nothing.
Right.
Because, you know, this is a business first. It's the film business. So if you're going to go ask a studio for money, you better be prepared like you're going to a bank asking for a loan, because they ain't going to give you money just based on an idea. Maybe if you're James Cameron or like Martin Scorsese or somebody like that. But even then, normally they have a great script. They have a presentation reel. They have all things to show them, right? If you get that opportunity, why wouldn't you be overprepared? So that's usually the first step, is getting your paperwork in order. It's the unmagical part of filmmaking, but you want to have your life rights.
What does the life right mean? I'm not sure what that is.
That you have the rights to do a documentary on them. Like, on now, the some subject, people yeah. might, if it's a bigger studio and people have more money, you might acquire like to be able to do a scripted version and everything well. You might say, okay, I'm going to pay you for your life rights so that I can acquire like to be able to do a series and a movie. That's usually what the bigger companies will do. They'll try to get everything and then they'll sub out, and then they'll like hire a company like me to say, okay, you do the doc. We'll do the dramatic feature of the series and you do, and the two don't conflict with each other. Cause if you're really into the story, you'll watch both, right? You're like, oh, I want to watch the, I like the actors. I'm going to watch the scripted one, but then I want to watch the documentary to get some of the finer details.
Right. Yeah.
So normally that's the first thing first. You get the paperwork done, you get the chain of title and your life rights, then you can actually officially go sell it. Then I can go to the networks and say, I have so-and-so's life rights. I now can pitch you and here's the story and here's what we plan to tell it. And the great thing with docs is they grow. Like our pitch deck when we start and then who's eventually in it and who all finds, that always grows, because until we sit down with the talent, like of course, we knew with Dolph, we're like, okay, we're going to interview Stallone. He's a huge part of the story. Grace Jones, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Van Damme. But then it was like, okay, who are the people that we don't know? And he's like, oh, well, you need to interview my original manager and business partner, Johan Prommel from Sweden. And you need to interview my acting teacher, Larry Moss, who told me, like, yeah, those are awesome. Like, and you really work with them to who are these important people to help tell their story. Nobody knows it better than the person telling it, at least with biography docs. If you're doing more like we did with cannabis, then you're looking at all the different researchers and who do you want? And then there is that entertainment piece, right? Where you're like, okay, if you have two qualified researchers, who's more charismatic? Back in the day, you had to guess. Nowadays, you can go on YouTube and almost everybody's at least got some. You're like, oh, these two doctors are both qualified. This guy's way more charismatic, or this girl's way better. Let's go with them. They look good on camera. They speak well. Those things, you know, and this is where earlier, you know, Pepper, you're talking about when you take a position, no matter, even people say they're the most unbiased, you are taking a position the moment you, the way you light it and the way you shoot it. That's taking a position, right? Like, so you are always going to have a position the way you're going to do it, right? So it's just a matter of being as authentic as you possibly can and presenting the information, but still has to be, it is entertainment. So you want to do it in an entertaining way, right? The best way for people to grasp information is if it's, you know, that's where, you know, in our marijuana docs, we'd have celebrities in there. You'd have Joe Rogan and Snoop Dogg and Richard Branson. And people are like, why are you putting those people in there? I was like, because, you know, they can relate to the common person, right? Or the culture of it, right? And they can say it in a way, like comedians are great at that, where like what they're saying is really intelligent, but it's very, it's also, you know, said in a way that the average person can really relate to versus a doctor that gives you like the scientific spin where you're like, I have no idea what he said, but that sounded very smart.
It's interesting to me, or as the layperson that enjoys watching the odd documentary, there are two types. There's the one you're telling with this Dolph Lundgren story where it's retroactively, it's in retrospect, the life in retrospect and what he's experiencing now. And then there's something like, and I'm going to bring up an old documentary that I don't imagine Dylan or Robbie you've heard of. Many people listening might not have heard of this, but as a fan of documentaries and somebody who appreciates their work, I'm sure you know the name Hoop Dreams.
Oh, of course, won the Oscar. That's an amazing. Right. That's like what you could say that Hoop Dreams and actually Canadian produced, you know, Boys on the Bus were like some of the first ones that really followed kind of sports teams in the moment, right? And like if you watch Boys on the Bus now, I just watched it not too long, like it's so classic 80s that like if you're doing it and you wanted to give that 80s feel, you're like, I would do it just like this, like typewriters for the graphic coming up, like. Like we're like younger generations, like, why are they making that sound?
Yeah.
Like, well, that's a typewriter. That's how you used to do like graphics and stuff. But Hoop Dreams is phenomenal. It won the Oscar.
Yeah. Hoop Dreams, you guys, was...
I recognize the cover because I worked in a...
You worked in a video store.
Yeah, but I've never seen it.
It was the first one where you're like, oh, documentary, like... What? Why is it getting so much love? So the idea behind it, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, Adam, but it followed two Chicago high school basketball players and their pursuit to make it pro. But it followed them, what I would assume would be, in real time. So as they were filming this, they didn't know how it would end with them.
No.
And I imagine the payoff that they wanted is one would end in tragedy and the other would end in success. I would imagine that would be kind of the idea behind it, because it would weave such a nice narrative and such a great story. But it ended up, they both kind of just faded into obscurity and never made it, right? That's how it ended. And it's almost like you can't plan for how one of these real-time documentaries is going to play out.
And that's what I think makes them, to me, that's what makes them so special and a little bit more magical, because you have to care about them a little more. You know, even with Dolph, like, we don't know exactly how it's going to end. We know we're going to interview in parts, but he's so open to talk right now. He's in a great part in his career where he's really reflecting, you know, and he just got over a divorce and he's in a new relationship now with a new fiance where he is in. That's every filmmaker's dream, is just when you're brutally honest on camera, the audience loves it. Right. They love to see that, you know, they love to see that even somebody successful and as iconic and, you know, genetically gifted as Dolph had struggles, like that the common man that you can relate to, like, oh man, he was abused by his dad. I was too. Wow. Like, he went through martial arts and had the same kind of insecurities and everything that, like, you want that. You never fully know how it's going to end. We didn't know how Danny Trejo's was going to end.
Originally, how stressful is that, though? You don't know if you're going to have an end. Is there going to be a payoff?
We always know there's going to be enough. Like, we know, you know, and this is why when we do biodocs like this, we try to bank into somebody that we know has a great following. Mm-hmm. And something I did learn, though, is because we did Chasing Evil. We did Robbie Knievel, Evel Knievel's son. And something that people really don't like to see is they don't like to see a complete crash and burn. You know, if it's an icon or a hero, if it's Tiger King, where they're all just a bunch of crazy people, people don't care if they were like, they're like, yeah, I want you guys to all crash and burn. But if it's anyone that was an icon, nobody likes to see just depressing, crash and burn. Like, you want to have conflict and resolution, right? You want to see people reach their peaks, have a fall, but come back with some kind of positive message at the end, right? Like, that's generally what people like to see. They don't like to see like rise, fall. I think about, you know, and I one of the least successful films I did was the Chasing Evil one, because Robbie Knievel, like, he's been a daredevil since he was 8 years old. He doesn't know how to do anything else. And daredevils, with all the stuff that we have for entertainment now, just aren't entertaining anymore. It's too quick, right? It's 15 seconds, you jump the ramp, it's over.
And most people are doing that just in their backyard on YouTube now. Like, kids.
I know, and that's the thing is, now that everybody has access to a camera, you can get people to do crazy things and they can film it on their TikTok, and it's just way easier to do. There's so much more content to compete against. Like, when him and his dad did it back in the day, there was nothing else like it. Now there's, like you said, there's crazy guys on their Instagram that are like hanging off of buildings with one hand and doing squirrel jump shoot things and things that are just insane that you can't keep up with. So it's still like our film won awards and had great critical acclaim, but it just didn't resonate with audiences because people didn't like to see their hero in such a downward way, right? And he's struggling with alcohol, he's in and out of jail. Like, it's, they don't like to see the crash and burn of a hero, right? They want to see that there's that resolution, that positive message on the outside, generally for a bio doc. That's what you see. People want to see that. So that's the one thing we try to look for to make sure that it isn't, you know, different if you're talking about like Killer Inside, like if it's a scumbag that you're catching, like a true crime thing, yeah. People want to see them get it, right? Like, right. Don't F with Cats and ones like that. Yep, they yep. want to see that, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's you're taking people that are an icon and you're only showing the crash, like, people generally don't like to see that. So we stay away from that. And then something personally, because we invest so much time with these docs, like, you know, we're going to be working with, you know, with Danny, we worked with for 3 years, Bisbing 3 years, you know, by the time of concept to delivery and release, it's about 3 years. You know, you really got to really care about the person and the story. So you like to make sure that they're good to work with. Right. And that was actually came up with Dolph's agent, because he was Michael Bisbing's agent. He was like, Adam, you know, Bisbing is just raving about this and he loves the film and we can't wait for it to release internationally. And it got picked up by a studio. And he's like, who else do I work with? And he gave me his Rolodex. And there are some other pretty iconic action stars too. And I won't mention any names, but I said one of them and I was like, oh, I'd love to do that. I grew up watching him too. And he warned me. He's like, well, he's straight up crazy. And I was like, really? Like, how crazy? I'm kind of good on crazy. He's like, really crazy. Like, might do something crazy, like answer the door naked to test you and crazy. And I was like, yeah, I'm kind of good with crazy right yeah. now. Who else okay. you got, right? And then he,
so
and then he was like, oh, Dolph Lundgren. He's like, he is one of my best clients. Nobody ever complains. He's such an awesome guy, down to earth, super. And then when we met and talked, like, we went through a lot of talks and then we went over the story to see if there would be enough for really that theatrical. And then we saw and then we watched his TED talk and how, like, he's really showing the man behind the action star, right? And even talking now where he says after Aquaman and Expendables 4, he doesn't think he's going to do any more action because, like, my body's falling apart. I have to get injections in my ankle to even walk and my shoulder's gone. I've had a double hip replacement. I blew out one of my hips even there working on Aquaman because I didn't want to tell them. Like, it's something that, you know, for all the critique that action stars get for not being maybe the most wide-range dramatic actor, the physical that they have to do for these movies, like, Stallone and him were just talking, we were hanging out with them, which I had to pinch myself with that, geeking out growing up to those two guys where they're talking. And Stallone's like, man, when I started, I saw that there's a niche. Charles Bronson, all those guys were retiring, that there was a niche for action guys. But in my generation, if you wanted to jump off a horse, it was like me and a stuntman had to jump off the horse. Nowadays, he's like, so much of it is graphics and they have foam pits that you do. He's like, I have so many injuries where simple things like just falling down the stairs in a fight scene, like you break your wrist or something like that, right? Like, we have tons of these injuries where nowadays, like, all the guys like, oh, we'll just fix it. We'll do an animation. We'll have a stunt double. He's like, you didn't get to do a lot of that when I was coming up. So we have a ton of injuries. Like, Stallone joked about when he's like, you know, you want to walk in the room and still play this persona like you're rocking this tough guy. And then when you go to sit on your chair, you're like a 100-year-old man. You're like, oh, is it there? I got the handle. Right. Okay, yeah, make sure I sit down. Don't fall down. I don't want to break a hip. You know, they go through a lot to be able to provide entertainment for everybody.
It's like that opening is there again because, like, Liam Neeson is doing action movies. You know, Schwarzenegger's in his, what, almost 70, I would guess. The Rock is pushing, what, mid-40s? And who's the next great action star, sure. right? They need to do it again. When you landed Arnold Schwarzenegger for the documentary, there must be moments when you land guests or interviews. We're like, yes, because they were hard to get or
you were every hunting time, and that, hunting that's for probably, them. That's probably what keeps the excitement for this, right? Is you know that the interview lists are going to be challenging, even when you've got great relationships, their schedules are busy, and you're asking them to do a free. We never pay for interviews, right? We always get them because the person wants to speak on this. And we do that for two reasons. One is we don't have the money. And two, you don't ever want to pay them to skew what they're saying. You want them to just honestly talk about what they feel about the situation or this individual. You don't want them to pay so they come on there and say, okay, what do you want me to say? You want me to say some things? Like, you want them to be honest and reflective and talk. So it is always exciting. And I made a point in this last trip, you know, maybe it's my age and having young kids, that, you know, our whole crew is just like, man, we get to do this for a living. Like, we just went to Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, and the UK. And we're following action stars that we grew up idolizing, like that helped, that inspired us to get into the film industry. And now we are telling their story, like, incredible. And I was even sharing with Dolph, cause he's such a great guy, like, just so cool. And he was like, man, even I forget until I go to like, you know, one of these Comic Cons and people are like, you changed my life. I got into fitness. I lost 100 pounds. Like, wow. You know, they don't even realize what they do for people. Right. And I was like, Dolph, I've got a story for you. How about Michael Bisping, a legitimate world champion and Hall of Fame UFC fighter, was inspired by the Rocky movies to become a world champion. That's what made him. You playing a character is what inspired him to become a real life world champion. And even Dolph was like, man, yeah, I never even thought about that, right? Like, so although it is entertainment, these guys are a big part of culture and who we grow up to be as adults, right? Those movies that impact you as you're younger are a part of who you are today. So when you get to tell their stories, it's an incredible responsibility that we don't take lightly. And I think that's why Dolph and all these people are coming to us, is because they see what we did with Danny Trejo, and they're like, man, he captured my story brilliantly. And we don't just do it for the money. I'm not, wouldn't be lying. This is how I make a living. I don't do anything else. This is how I earn a living. But, you know, I love what I do.
And there's a pride in the craft.
Yes. Yeah. If I didn't truly care about Dolph's story, I shouldn't be the guy to tell it. Like, me and my team care about every aspect, and he isn't part of it through it the whole way. And I partner with the talent. I don't just get their life rights. They become my 50-50 partner. So this is their story. Like, we will make sure that we get it right.
This is how it comes full circle, though, because like, what you just described, as dumb as it sounds, that's why having Devin Retray or Buzz in my garage, having beers and joints in my garage, was so mind-blowing to me. And I know it's not a huge celebrity nowadays, but like, I watched him when I was young. I watched it every single year. And now this guy, and his part wasn't big. Like, if Macaulay was there, obviously it would be a lot different.
Yeah.
But there he is in my garage, and just my head, I'm like, what the hell? So I could totally understand, like, when you're talking about like these action stars were huge stars, and then you're beside them going like, where the hell am I in my life? That I grew up, like my brother and I grew up acting out.
Interviewing Schwarzenegger.
Right? Like, that's crazy to me.
Who is the hardest interview, hardest guest that you've ever had to get and that you celebrated the most when you finally got the okay?
We're coming up to some of the biggest ones here, but I mean, it was really tough with, we're working with The Rock on another project, and I mean, his schedule is just crazy. His company, $7, is fantastic to work with, but We're trying to sit down with him, still working on that. Let's see, who was like the one that was really tough? And then we got him. So maybe not the toughest, but an interesting one is when, you know, I think every Canadian, I got to interview Wayne Gretzky, right? When we did Grant Fuhrer's, right? Now, Wayne was, you know, he's incredibly busy here in Canada, maybe not as big as some of the American or international stars, but he agreed to do 20 minutes, right? And this talks about being prepared. He showed up an hour early for the interview. Now, to give you an idea, when we do our interviews, this isn't just like we throw in a camera and turn a light. Our lighting takes 2.5-3 hours to set up because we're making it look cinematic. Like, we're everything. So when they sit down, it's ready. We have 2 cameras, sometimes 3, so we have all different angles. We went in overprepared because I said, look, we only have 20 minutes with Wayne. We want to go and get this done. And he comes in. He's like, hey, guys, you ready? And we're like, holy shit, like, our director's not even here. And then he's like, you ready? And we're like, yeah. So we call our director. We're like, where are you? He's like, man, I'm 45 minutes away at best. And they're like, okay, well, Adam, you're going to have to do the interview. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll take one for the team and I'll interview the great one. So, and we did it. So that one was pretty cool because just being overly prepared. I've done enough of these now that when you have the big, you know, celebrity or star or international person that is willing to give you their time for free, you know, and those listening, they're kind of like, oh, how tough is it? I'm like, you got to remember, these people, everybody wants something from them 24/7, including their family. Mm-hmm. I've been sitting around family members of big stars who are around, and even they are timing. They're looking at the schedule and they're like, look, Dad has some downtime around 2:00. We'll pitch him the idea then. Their own children trying to pitch them, right? I couldn't imagine what it's like where every single person and everywhere that you go wants something from them. Even them, I try to go, well, I don't want anything. I'm like, Adam, you're an idiot. Of course you want something. You're trying to get a free interview from them that you're going to put on an international documentary and use to sell. Like, everybody wants something from them. So it is always very exciting and nerve-wracking. And, you know, because obviously, too, you're dealing with a real person, right? If you do something on set that pisses them off and they're kind of like, whoa, what do you think? Like, I'm out, right? I'm doing a free interview. I don't have to be paid to be here, right? So it is this nerve-wracking, exciting. I think that's probably what keeps us coming back.
Trying to weave that narrative and be delicate while getting to the point at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, and then trying to get them to open up in the 20 minutes or hour that you have, right, to tell you some really cool stuff in a way that isn't like the interviews they've done. It's very challenging, but it is super exciting when you nail it and you know you have a great interview. You come out of there. Like, I think those are the thrills that really keep us coming back for years to deal with like the struggles of the financing and the constant rejections. And, you know, even when you go through everything and not getting into festivals, like, I think it's that challenge of telling the great stories and overcoming those. And then when you land that big interview, but the ones you're talking about now, that's a long answer to your question, Bubba, but it'd be all those guys like Stallone, Arnold, Van Damme. We're going through all these right now. They've all confirmed, but we haven't locked them in for their interviews yet. We were just shooting B-roll with Stallone and everybody in the UK with him and Dolph hanging out. So we haven't got that sit-down interview yet, which we need.
Yeah, kind of waiting on those, huh?
Yeah.
Speaking of interviews, I told you we were going to be 15 minutes, free. Yeah. So I apologize about that. I said, hey, can we have 15 minutes of your time? And you've given us a ton more.
Yeah, one thing I'm really curious about, just one-sentence answers to these. You said it was the golden age of documentaries.
Correct.
We're going to list off some of the more recent golden age of documentary titles.
Okay.
I would assume, being a fan of the craft, you've seen all or most of them. And just one sentence, what you thought, is it good, is it not good, did you love it? Okay. So, in no particular order, Making a Murderer.
Only seen parts of it.
Really?
Okay. How could you stop that show?
Yeah, it got a little old.
All right. Yeah.
The new 9/11 series, the War on Terror, the one.
Ooh, hearing great things, haven't seen it yet. I was away when that came out. That's on my queue.
Okay.
What about The Last Dance?
Yes.
Oh, The Last Dance is spectacular. It's amazing. I don't know.
You didn't find it too much of an advertisement for Nike and the narrative controlled by Michael Jordan the entire time?
You definitely saw that, but also Jordan is like ripped throughout the interview, so he's pretty honest.
He was. What about the Tiger Woods one?
I would have liked to actually heard from Tiger in that one. I didn't love it. I would have liked to have actually heard from him, but I mean, he's not going to sit down and go through all that, but I'm waiting for when they do get that from him, from his voice. I think it'd be good for him to do that, to be honest.
Don't F with Cats.
Yes.
Love Don't F. Like, we're actually doing a series on that right now about Arturo Thundergatti and his death in Brazil, and we've literally structured it a three-part series like Don't F with Cats.
Is that the music guy, the heavy metal guy?
No, Arturo Gatti is the boxer that died in Brazil. He's from Montreal, but everybody thought he was the one that fought. He fought Mayweather. He had the legendary battles with Mickey Ward, which is who Mark Wahlberg played in The Fighter. Very iconic, and everybody, but so many parts of that story are just wrong. Like, even people are like, oh, he's the Italian Stallion, fought out of New Jersey from Italy. No, he's born in Montreal. He's Canadian. So he spoke French, or like, you know, Canadian French. So we're doing a three-part series on that. I absolutely love Don't App with Cats.
Yeah, that was
great. Such a unique, brilliantly put together. It's one of those ones when I watch
it. I gotta watch it, Dylan.
The OJ documentary.
That was great. That was at Sundance when I came out. Loved it.
Yeah. My favorite documentary I think I've ever watched is Comedian with Jerry Seinfeld.
I've heard about this. I have not watched this one. I've not seen that one. No, I've heard it's great, though.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It just, the anguish he puts himself through to come up with new material is well documented. And it's kind of a paradox against an up and coming comedian with a big ego and a bad attitude, and mm-hmm. how the two stories align. Now, there's a Bill Cosby scene in the end, which may be a little different now.
Yeah.
But for what it was at the time. And then anything with David Attenborough.
Oh.
Anything. So any of the BBC, Planet Earth,
Life in Color,
all of those. Yeah. Like, you have to at least respect the patience.
Those are all
and the camera work.
He's a legend. Those are all spectacular stuff, and the way they shoot those are, there's stuff that I watch now, and I never try to pick apart other people's work, but I'm just, when I see a cool story, I'm like, oh, I love how they did this. I'm like, I would have tried that differently. I like what they did here. And then when a really good one gets you, like Don't F with Cats, I remember just being like, I just was like enamored.
Watch it as
a
fan. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just like, wow, that's when it really captures you. And it's, I love that one.
The most notable scene in all of those David Attenborough ones, and I don't know what episode or which series it was, but when they finally found the snow leopard.
Yeah.
And yeah. it's the rarest
most,
of animals.
It's the most elusive animals on the
and
planet.
And they had a camera set up for so long. Like, how long and how big would the celebration be when you've been trying to catch a snow leopard on camera for who knows how long, and it finally happens?
I couldn't imagine those. Like, I know we set up, like you said, we shoot, and you know, average film, we shoot hundreds of hours, and we keep 90 minutes. So, like, I couldn't imagine one of those nature shows. That is something that always kind of pulls me. I'm like, how did they get these shots? These are incredible.
It's like CGI. Yeah.
Or if they're doing underwater ones, I'm like, man, were they just underwater all the time until these creatures come around? Yeah. Like, my God.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's great to learn more about the documentary, the entire business process and the creation process, and of course how streaming is destroying the world, but also great at the same time. It's
like everything in life, there's a yin and a yang. But thank you very much, guys, for having me.
Can I ask one more question, Adam?
Yeah.
What's a successful guy like you doing listening to a show like ours on a Wednesday morning?
Hey, well, you guys probably get, so with the constant evolution and change of the way that we consume media, and radio's probably been at the brunt of this for decades, being like, oh, radio's done, right? Once TV came in, radio's done, still wasn't done. Once podcasting, you guys, man, you just really, it feels like home when I listen to you, the banter, the fun you guys have. I honestly like to listen to you guys more than I like when the music comes on. The music, I know, is a big system that's pushed by the big artists. I really just think you guys do a great way of making people feel comfortable at home. Pepper and Dylan, how you guys are so honest about your personal life and stuff. It's very much like a podcast. I love to hear that. Robbie, the adventures you go on, for me, that's kind of, I think that's again going why docs. I think that's why you connect with an audience, is you guys are just very real about what your personal lives are, and you guys give back to the community. So like literally as soon as I just got home from Europe yesterday, and I turned it on this morning because I wanted to hear you know, what is it, the Beat the Bank or whatever. Cash Vault, and just hear you guys go and rant. And actually, my wife and I won a vacation from your radio station. That was a few years ago. So it's just that. I think you guys have a really great trio with the relationship of years of working together. And, you know, Pepper, you being very honest about your addiction and going through that, my brother goes
How do I get
that,
Pepper's life rights?
Yeah,
I think there's a story there.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say, you can have our shitty life rights anytime. I don't imagine it'll cost very much, but
it's refreshing, guys. It makes me feel at home when I listen to you guys' show. Yeah. You guys do a great job.
Well, you got to love what you do, like you said, right?
Thanks, man.
Yeah, so, you can tell that. You guys are very passionate about what you do, so I find you guys don't come off as like the cheesy old radio, like, listen in. It just seems like you guys are you guys, right?
I wish we could do that. All right. Well, thank you very much, Adam. We appreciate your time.
No problem.
Okay,
and I look forward to next time we do a screening here in town, I'll make sure I have invites for all you guys.
You got it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
Take care.
Bye, guys.
See you later. A lot of insight there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Interesting stuff, you know, to think about the amount of work. I've always thought about that, to invest into, I hope this true life story works out. Right. I've got this idea, you see, and I don't know how it's going to end. Give me money.
That's tough.
Know, right?
Very, very cool.
So we thank Adam Scorgi. You can keep your eye open on Super Channel for the all of his projects and the Dolph Lundgren, which sounds really interesting, right?
Don't steal it.
Yeah.
Before, you know, when he said, I'm doing a thing on Dolph Lundgren, I thought, oh, well, okay. But then as he tells the story, that he's got an interesting story, and you can never judge these documentaries until you start to watch it.
This is what I'm saying.
Why am I interested in this? It's great.
The other night, I got caught up in, Robbie, can you find the title for me? It's that, the Trashers or whatever it was. I was at home, and I'm scrolling through, and you know, when you scroll through Netflix, I'm just looking for something, and half the time, you spend too much time scrolling, and I came across the trailer for whatever this was.
It's part of the series, right? Untold, the crime and penalties.
Yes.
Of what?
Of a hockey team.
This hockey and
the Danbury mobster that owned Trashers. The hockey team. Yeah.
I had zero interest in this story.
Yeah.
I have zero interest in hockey.
Mm-hmm.
All I saw is wrestling meets Mighty Ducks, and I'm like, this is interesting. And I turn it on, and I'm just fascinated by it, but how it can pull you into this story. And there you're just, I wanted to learn everything possible with Mob Boss, Mighty Ducks, and wrestling all thrown into one.
Yeah.
But like once you see, once you kind of start following him, then you're just hooked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting to watch things that you would never care about, ever, in a million years. And now I'm like, I love that story.
Well, and Adam, you can tell he does his job for the love of it. You know, he's never going to be a household name. What documentarians outside of Michael Moore are, you do it for the love, and you do it to tell a great story. And he does that, definitely does that. So we thank him for his time. And as always, we thank you for listening to the After Show.
The Pepper and Dylan Show. Weekday mornings on KISS 91.7.